And as you're coming up, let me tell you, we did get the motion to dismiss relating to the bank. I assume the bank won't be arguing today, or is that not a fair assumption?
That is a fair assumption, Your Honor.
All right, very good. Thank you.
If it pleases the court, counsel, to address that in a little more detail, we have reached a full and complete settlement of our request for review of the claims against Colorado Community Bank. And that prompted the notice of dismissal or the motion to dismiss. I don't think we were clear as to procedurally how to do this. I don't know that Rule 42 specifically addresses a partial dismissal of a claim.
Yeah, let me ask, because what you just said is not considered. Can we stop the time, Mr. Mead? I want to make sure I'm understanding, because the motion to dismiss sounded like you were dismissing the abusive process and civil conspiracy claims were dismissed, but not the claims where the bank and the interveners had joined. Is it both the claims both ways dismissed on behalf of the bank?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I apologize. The question, it sounded to me the defendants here were dismissing their counterclaims against the bank for abuse of process and civil conspiracy because of the settlement.
That is correct.
All right. The bank also joined with the interveners in the receivership, the sale issue claims, and they joined in the motion to dismiss the appeal. It sounded to me from the motion, the stipulation of dismissal, that claim is still alive on behalf of the bank. I could be wrong.
It is alive. I don't know that it specifically. It's a tricky situation, Your Honor, given the fact that my clients, the appellants, were not parties to that order. That order simply transferred title to real estate held by KDGC Holdings, one of the defendants and the two defendant subsidiaries, to a third party, or to the interveners.
Right.
We were not specifically a party to that order. The order was requested by the receiver and the interveners. I don't recall that the bank joined in that motion for approval.
Well, I know they did on the appeal. That's why I was asking the question. The bank's answer brief in this case begins by saying we join in the interveners' arguments relating to the sale of the assets. And that's what I'm trying
we
to figure out. What was dismissed? In terms of dismissal, we granted that order this morning.
Okay.
So we are, we signed it.
The briefs, if it might help, the briefs were filed prior to the settlement. The settlement.
I understand, but I'm trying to figure out what was settled, and I'm sorry to take so much time here, but I want to make sure we got it right.
My understanding is that we have settled, and what we have dismissed is the summary judgment, the appeal of the summary judgment on the counterclaim against the bank for abuse of process and civil conspiracy.
Great, that's how I understood it. I appreciate your clarification, gentlemen. Is that your understanding as well?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I thank you for taking the time. Just wanted to make sure we get it procedurally right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
With that, my apologies for taking your time. We can start the time and you can begin.
Oh, I get the whole 15 minutes back?
Yeah, we'll give you your 15 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Again, I will not be addressing the issue as to the bank on the dismissal of the counterclaim for abuse of process and civil conspiracy.
I think I interrupted you before you introduced yourself, so why don't you do that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. My name is Jim Shearer. I am appearing on behalf of the defendant appellants, Oxford Resource Management, Inc., and Walter Gene Hoffman. I do want to spend a little time going over the factual background of the case. I think it's a bit complex and confusing in this case. And in reading the briefs and preparing for argument today, I'm not sure I did a stellar job in laying it out in a clear and comprehensive manner. I think the facts are key to the decision on both issues on appeal. This case, as the court is aware, involves KDGC Holdings, Colorado Limited Liability Company. Which owned three golf and country clubs, two in El Paso County, one down in Pecosa Springs. It owned these clubs through its 100% membership interest in three subsidiary LLCs. KDGC LLC, which held title to King's Deer Golf Club and Monument. Woodmore Pines Golf and Country Club LLC, which held titled to the Woodmore Pines Golf and Country Club, also in Monument, and Pagosa Spring Valley Golf and Country Club, LLC, which held titled to the Pagosa Springs Golf and Country Club in Pagosa Springs. KDGC Holdings was managed by Mr. Hoffman through his LLC, KDGC Management LLC. KDGC Holdings was owned by four people, each of whom held membership or equity membership interests. Mr. Hoffman through Oxford Resource and Management Inc. And the three interveners, Mr. Edelberg, Mr. Williams, and Mr. Harshberg. At the relevant time, the assets of two of the subsidiaries, KDGC and Woodmore Pines, were encumbered by secured debt payable to Community Bank of Colorado in the approximate amount of about $7.3 million. This debt had been incurred as a result of acquisition, purchase money interests, and operating loans for operating expenses. In November of 2009, the bank asserted a default under the notes secured by these deeds of trust and these security agreements, and brought an action in the El Paso County District Court asserting that default and requesting a receiver. That motion was granted by the district court ex parte shortly thereafter, based upon the allegations in the verified complaint. Upon appointment, the receiver immediately replaced Mr. Hoffman as the manager of KDGC Holdings and arranged a $3 million additional loan from the bank. And brought that to the court for approval. That was approved by the district court in January of 2010, January 8. Under the terms of the loan, as proposed to the court and is eventually closed, the purpose of that loan was to cure the default under the underlying $7.3 million existing loans, bring those current, and set up an interest reserve to ensure future debt service on the three loans. At this point, that loan closed January 25, 2010. About 10 days later, February 1, 2010, the bank filed a notice of election and demand on the Woodmore Pines property, asserting a default under the note and deed of, under the deed of trust securing the indebtedness owed by Woodmore Pines. About 3 weeks later, on February 22nd, they filed a second notice of election of demand on the King's Deer property in Monument. During this time period, February 2010, the interveners formed Tri-Lakes Golf, LLC, Colorado Limited Liability Company. It was owned by the interveners and an associate of theirs, Mr. Zaleski. Shortly thereafter, about a week after, they formed Tri-Lakes Golf Holdings, LLC, also owned by the three interveners. Now, in my opening brief, I stated my understanding that Tri-Lakes Golf Holdings was a holding company for Tri-Lakes Golf. That, in reviewing the record, is not incorrect. The interveners owned both entities directly. 2 weeks after that,
you know, I'm going to, if I can interrupt here, Mr. Chair, because you've got now 9 minutes and 30 seconds, and I really want to get to the issue, legal issues, if I can.
Okay.
I'd like to talk about the jurisdictional issue first, and you argue that the sale orders here were not the disposition of an entire claim, so the 54B certification was not proper. How do you define claim, and why do you think it was not properly certified as a claim?
Well, the cases define a claim as it's in the brief, and I probably did more eloquently there, but the cases define a claim as an aggregate set of facts giving rise to a particular relief. In this case, the claim, so to speak, applying that test, was the receivership itself. There were two claims in the bank's original verified complaint. A claim for judgment on default and a claim for receivership. The receivership itself I think, given the test, was the claim for relief itself.
So, and let me drill down a little bit on that. With obviously, receivers do a whole bunch of different things, and they can sell assets, they can do whatever. Is it your position that there's never an individual act that the receiver may take that could be construed as a claim here?
Yes, that would be our position. I think, you know, given the definition of a claim in the case law, there isn't any case law, certainly, that I have found that specifically addressed this issue, either here or outside the jurisdiction. But
did you? I think, and you may have cited the case law. I looked at a lot of law myself on this because it is a difficult issue. There was some suggestion, at least, that if you could bring the claim independently, that would suggest it's, or that the motion, if you will, if it's kind of stands alone and you could have brought a claim on it, that would, we could call it a claim for purposes of 54B. You correct me if that's not consistent with your understanding of the law, but I think I saw law to that effect. If so, couldn't a receiver or an individual, the bank or the interveners, have brought a judicial dissolution proceeding as a separate claim?
They certainly could have, and that would have been a claim for relief given the case law definition.
So is it just a form issue here that if they brought it, they just didn't call it the right thing, and that's why you couldn't certify it? My question, and I promise you, not critical at all. I'm just trying to figure it out. I mean, it sounds like that may elevate form over substance if we were to rule that way. Go for it.
I'll do my best, Your Honor. I don't know that I would characterize it as simply a form issue. In fact, they did not ask for, that's not what they did. And had they asked for a judicial dissolution and a distribution, then certainly that is a claim for relief. This was a motion by the receiver during the course of the receivership proceeding. I think that's conceptually different. And I think in substance, it does not resolve the claim for relief. There was no claim asserted in any of the pleadings for a sale of the property. In other words, this was done on the motion of the receiver. This was part of the administration of the receivership estate. And I don't think that's a form issue. I think that's more a substantive issue, if I could.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
With respect to the merits of the court's order of dissolution and distribution, I think that we've raised two challenges to that. The first one being was procedurally improper. In other words, you had to be done. You have to file a claim for relief, and you have to litigate that claim for relief. Here, it was done by motion during hearing, at the court's invitation to intervener's counsel. The statute, the LLC judicial dissolution statute, contemplates a full case, you know, filing of a pleading, opportunity for discovery, opportunity to respond. So I think this was a matter of substance rather than form. I think the appellants were prejudiced by the way the court went about it.
How so? Could you address that?
They had no notice of it. They had no notice that would be an issue at the hearing. They had no opportunity to investigate the merits of that, do any factual investigation, discovery, and had no opportunity to prepare.
I'm going to hear that. What would you have done? I mean, can you be specific? You certainly tried a pretty good case. I mean, what would you have done differently?
I wasn't counsel back then. Counsel back then did do a very good job, in my view. But I would have.
And you're doing a fine job too.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it would have taken depositions of the various principals, certainly taken a deposition of somebody at the bank, gotten much more detail on the structure, and also gotten some information regarding the statutory grounds for a dissolution of an LLC by a member or a manager.
Now, did your colleague who tried the case below raise the issue at all, object at all to going forward?
He did in response. He didn't at the hearing, but he did in response to the the proposed written order that came out in July of 2010. He did raise that issue, and I do have a record cite in my reply brief where he did that.
Thank you.
The issue with respect to the transfer of the assets, the judicial dissolution of Pagosa Springs, and the transfer of the assets is pretty straightforward. Pagosa Springs wasn't a party. They were never served. They were never named as a party. There was no claim asserted against them in the complaint or in the complaint and intervention, the amended complaint and intervention. They brought no claims. It brought no claims of its own. It's black letter law that entity that is not a defendant is not within the personal jurisdiction of the court. And given the situation here, since the it was done in the context of a receivership proceeding, the assets of that company had to be part of the receivership estate in order to be within the jurisdiction of the district court.
Didn't the court order the receivership, I forgot the exact words, but it was something like this company, and all of their affiliates?
Use that and their affiliates, I think, was the language.
Yeah, and so why doesn't the and their affiliates kind of at least get Pagosa under the jurisdiction of the receiver when the court says you have jurisdiction over these companies and their affiliates?
Well, they were never served with process. They were never named as a party in the litigation. The Bush versus Winkler case, cited in both parties' briefs, addresses this issue. And I think it's pretty close on point. Basically, it says in this kind of situation, you know, you can't be doing, you can't be appointing a receiver in the first place. You cannot be playing with this entity's assets or exercising jurisdiction over those assets. I see I have about a minute 45. I would ask to reserve.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Robert Marsh on behalf of the appellees, registration number 31104. Beginning, Your Honor, with the issue of the timeliness of this appeal and this court's jurisdiction to address it as a consequence, the issues concerning 54B certification are subtle, but there is guidance in Colorado law. Most recently, the Supreme Court's decision in the Scott versus Scott case in 2006 addressed the finality of judgments in the context of a probate proceeding, which is of course analogous in itself to the receivership, which involves a continuing in rem jurisdiction over an estate and its management and ultimately its disposition, as is established in the Midland versus Cali case cited in our briefs. In the Scott case, the Supreme Court approached each petition in probate as a separate proceeding and found that each such proceeding was final and certifiable under Rule 54B when the issues presented by that petition were concluded. That is consistent with the instructions we have relative to receiverships in particular. First, Rule 66 establishes that a receivership may be the sole claim in a complaint. As a consequence, that is suggestive that the claim for appointment of the receiver is in and of itself a singular, separate claim, which may be but need not be inextricably intertwined with any of the other issues raised in the case. Likewise, we have Colorado Appellate Rule 1A4, which establishes that the claim for appointment of the receiver is itself immediately appealable without regard to what else may be pending in the case. Again, these rules establish that the appointment of a receiver is itself an independent cause of action that may be separately appealed. And finally, we have a couple of cases that are instructive. Both of them Colorado Supreme Court cases, one being Peterson versus Daniels, cited at 192 Pacific Reporter 498, a decision in 1920, wherein the Supreme Court decided that a denial of discharge of a receiver was itself a final, immediately appealable order. The denial, of course, implies administration is ongoing. that there are other issues that may be pending, but that singular issue, that singular petition for discharge, was viewed as a final order and was immediately appealable. Similarly, in the Marker versus City Savings Building and Loan Association case cited at 73 Pacific 2nd 991, the court addressed the situation in which an assignee of a right in the receivership estate had asserted an action requesting distribution from the estate. That petition was denied, and the Supreme Court found that that petition was in and of itself a final a claim that when finally resolved by denial of the petition for distribution was itself final and immediately appealable. So though I have been unable to find any more recent authorities establishing that analogous to the probate situation, each petition in a receivership's pending administration is itself separately appealable, we have both rules and precedent suggesting that that is the case. There is really no dispute that certification of these orders was appropriate. There's been no timely appeal of that, and it bears note that there was in the notice of appeal a suggestion that that would be an issue in this case. It's not in the briefs, and as a consequence, it's undisputed that 54B certification was appropriate.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, I think procedurally, I just want to make sure I don't have this wrong. This motions division of this court deferred that issue. There were motions to dismiss the appeal at a response, and the motions division deferred that to the merits division. So I think it is in front of us, unless I missed something.
Your Honor, I think procedurally you have it exactly correct.
Okay.
My point was that the district court's judgment, the district court's order certifying it, is not on appeal. All that's pending is the motion, and it is, of course, a jurisdictional issue that we're addressing today for that reason.
Right, and again, just want to make sure I understand. And the issue, and we get, I think, drilling down, because Mr. Scherer argues with some force that the court should have never certified the issue at all. It was not a certifiable question. So I think we do have to address that question, unless I'm missing something.
I don't think so, Your Honor, but I think the rules and the case laws we've discussed establish that it is individually certifiable without regard to what, if any, other issues were pending in the district court at the time. I also wanted to turn to the issue of the allegation of an absence of jurisdiction over Pagosa, Your Honor, because I think it's been largely misunderstood.
Hey, and before you go on to that, Mr. Marshall, I can ask, I was taking notes. You talked about the Scott case, the Peterson case, and I think Marker was the last one, if I remember. I don't recall that any of those were cited in your briefs, were they?
No, Your Honor. Those cases were developed later. They're not cited in the briefs.
All right. So a couple of things. Let me just suggest to you that in the future, if you do that, you really shouldn't be talking about cases not cited in your briefs. It's not fair to the other party. So, Mr. Scherer, we'll enter an order. We'll give you how much time? I'm going to give you time to respond to those cases. And we'll set a limit, you know, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 pages. How long would you need to do that? And please tell me it's in the range of a week.
Your Honor, may I have the clock stopped? I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Would you stop? Thank you, Mr. Meehan.
In the range of a week. I am familiar with the Scott case, Your Honor.
All right. Well, in fairness to you, I mean, I'm going to give you a couple of days here. So we'll give you, say, till a week from today, and we'll issue an order that lets you file something. You'll do it through the e-filing system, and we'll do that to get that done. We'll give you, a week from today, and you're right now, and I guess I'll ask you, Mr. Marston, please don't cite cases that are not in your brief from here on, to let you respond, Mr. Scherer, to the Scott case, the Peterson case, and the Marker case. And we'll go from there. And I apologize for interrupting you, Mr. Marsh. Just want to be fair to both sides.
Understood, Your Honor, and no objection, certainly.
All right. Mr. Meade, could you set, I took up some of your time. I think probably used about 20 seconds. Could you set it for 9:10? And if you can't, don't worry about it. We'll give you an extra couple seconds at the end.
That's fine, Your Honor. I will proceed and thank you. Turning to the issue of jurisdiction over Pagosa Valley, which I will refer to simply as Pagosa, it has been contended that that was necessary or is somehow an essential foundation of the order requiring the sale of assets, and it just isn't so. The fact of the matter is that the appellants here acknowledge that Pagosa was not a party, that Pagosa, there were no claims asserted against it, and that it never appeared. Now, reasonable minds might differ on that because, of course, Pagosa, through its sole manager and sole owner, which was KDGC Holdings, did have involvement in the case and did cooperate with the receiver in accomplishing the subjection of its assets to the refinance loan that was approved in the receivership estate, and also the sale that ultimately occurred. If Pagosa is not a party and is not present, it certainly can and absolutely did cooperate and sell its assets by consent, and there was no order that required or prevented it from doing so. Equally as important is the fact that the appellant's efforts to create the picture that there is an empty chair someplace in this room, that there should have been another party present to make arguments, glosses over the fact that all of the interested parties were present and before the court. It's acknowledged that every one of the owners of all of these different companies, Pagosa included, were served, were parties, appeared, argued, objected, presented what evidence they could in response to the petitions and as relevant to the district court's decision. So there was simply no irregularity in any of these proceedings that had a substantive impact on any of the parties' rights. Every one of the individuals was present, and as a consequence, to the extent there was any irregularity in venue or failure of service, these are really harmless errors because all of the human beings that had any interest in these companies were present and fully participated before the court. Turning then to the issue of the district court's approval of the sale and its reference to corporate law. Again, this is really an irregularity of no consequence because the court's findings were sufficient regardless of whether it is considered an order of dissolution as the appellants insist, or whether it is considered an approval of the sale of receivership assets within the court's equitable jurisdiction under the Midland case to operate, to manage and dispose of the receivership estate. Turning first to the issue of dissolution, if we are to view the order as one of dissolution, then the requirements of 1380.810, this is the dissolution statute relative to LLCs, required nothing but a finding that it was not, quote, reasonably practicable to carry on the business in conformity with its operating agreement, end quote. The findings at issue here, of course, were that these companies were deadlocked as a result of the disputes between their members, and that they were insolvent as a result of the misdirection, if you will, of funds to Mr. Hoffman's personal uses. The suggestion that those findings are insufficient to establish that it was reasonably impractical to continue operating these businesses is pure form over substance, and that is demonstrated as well by the district court's additional findings, which included that the corporations are stymied and that absent the sale of the assets, they could no longer continue to operate and that the businesses will not continue absent some change. Those findings are expressed in the record and the rulings at page 4215, excuse me, and as a practical matter constitute a perfectly well-founded decision that there was no means to reasonably, practically continue carrying on these businesses, which is the requisite finding under the LLC Act. There is also the issue of the alleged procedural irregularity, that the statute requires a proceeding, and that that proceeding be in the county in which the assets are located. The fact of the matter is that there was a proceeding here, of course. There were lengthy proceedings, repeated proceedings, several hearings, written applications and motions. Mr. Shearer argued to you this morning that the proceeding I believe his word was, I can't remember his word, but the proceeding should have been an entire trial with pleadings and discovery and motions for summary judgment and all of the things that attend those things. But there's simply nothing in the statute that requires it. There was a proceeding here, and the irregularity that that proceeding took place in El Paso County as opposed to Archuleta County, where Pagosa Springs is not so much as alleged to have resulted in any prejudice whatsoever. So again, we have an appellate rule 35E issue where the irregularity does not result, to the extent there is any, in a reversible error because it had no impact on the rights of the parties in this appeal. And then if we view the order approving sale on its face as what it was, which was an order authorizing the receiver to sell these assets, again, the findings are entirely appropriate. Under the Midland case, the receiver, as an officer of the court, had exclusive jurisdiction over the assets subject to the receivership, and that included their disposition. Now, this is made clear in several ways, but one of them is the provisions of the LLC Act establishing that it is entirely proper for a receivership in the context of a dissolution proceeding to provide for the disposal, the sale of all of the assets of the receivership estate, and that's all that happened here. The last issue is, of course, the question of summary judgment.
Before you go into that, counsel, can I just ask you, I understood your argument where you said that this really was just a sale and we should, a judicial sale, we should review it that way. I'm just trying to figure out how we analytically do that because the court didn't think it could do that. I mean, I understand you think the court was wrong, or as a Heppner or whatever the case is, the court didn't think the court could do that. You characterize as court was trying to find a hook. I think Mr. Scherer would say, no, the court was deciding I'm going to do a dissolution. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I understand either way. But analytically, can we say this was a judicial sale when the court didn't think that's what it was doing?
I think the issue, Your Honor, is that it doesn't matter one way or the other. If it was a dissolution, the findings were appropriate and it should be affirmed for that basis. If there was some irregularity and it needs to be considered a sale, the findings were appropriate in that context as well. So all of this boils down to affirmance as the appropriate result.
Thank you.
Turning to the issue of summary judgment, the allegation on summary judgment is really that Oxford and Mr. Hoffman were entitled to an inference. A close reading of the brief suggests that there is entirely absent from it any suggestion that the actual facts were in dispute. Now, that's for a good reason. It's because they weren't. The material facts were not in dispute. But what Mr. Hoffman suggests he was entitled to and would overcome the ability of the district court to enter summary judgment was an inference. An inference of what, you'll ask me? Well, that is an inference of two things, motive and improper purpose, improper use of a judicial proceeding for purposes of abuse of process. Notably, in the Mintz case cited in our brief at 284 Pacific 3rd 62 and in Walker versus Van Lanningham, which Judge Plank will be familiar with from his concurrence, it was expressly held that improper use cannot be inferred from improper motive, and that motive is irrelevant absent proof of improper use. In this case, no one has done anything but what they had the legal right to do. The bank had the right to appoint a receiver. It did so to protect its collateral, and it's really uncontested that appointment of the receiver for that purpose was appropriate. After the appointment of the receiver, the bank and the appellee sought approval of a business transaction, a loan. There's no contest that they did that was an improper or out of the ordinary use of the receivership proceeding. There was then the formation of Trilinks, which excluded Mr. Hoffman. But of course, the appellees had the legal right to form that company as well. I see that my time has expired. You've been generous. May I just conclude my thought?
Finish the sentence and...
What it boils down to, Your Honors, is that the appellees had the legal right to do everything they did through approval of the transactions and formations of companies that did not involve Mr. Hoffman in accordance with the Supreme Court's decision in Nelson versus Elway. That's neither abuse of process nor a conspiracy claim.
Thank you, Mr. Marsh.
Thank you.
Sure, you got a minute and 45, and you know, why don't we give you 2.5 minutes?
Thank you very, very much, Your Honor. I'll try to be efficient. As I said, I can't address the Scott decision cited by counsel as luck would have it. I have it come up in a different appeal I'm working on. That case addresses the question of when an order is considered to be final for the purpose of Rule 54B certification, not whether that order disposes of a final claim. It's fairly straightforward. It does not address the issue that's before the court now. With regard to the jurisdiction of Gosa Springs, counsel, again, is in his brief, appears to argue that they were sort of virtually represented by the fact that KDGC Holdings was a party to the case and was represented, or was at least a party to the case. Again, that is not enough. There is nothing in the record to show that Pagosa Springs was an alter ego of its holding company, KDGC Holdings, so as to make KDGC Holdings' appearance in the case, naming as a defendant, and service on them to equate to personal jurisdiction over Pagosa Springs. Case, it's black letter law. If you don't have personal jurisdiction over the party, if they are not a party, you don't have jurisdiction to issue orders affecting that party's assets. And that applies with equal force to the in rem jurisdiction issue with respect to receivership assets or assets of the receivership estate. Very briefly, I have about 35 seconds left on the appeal of the dismissal of the counterclaim. Counsel's argument is that there is no genuine issue of fact as to one of the necessary elements of our claim of abuse process being use of a legal proceeding in an improper manner. I think the record is amply sufficient to support an inference that the interveners, in concert with the bank, utilized the receivership as a vehicle to effect the transfer of ownership of the three golf courses from Mr. Hoffman, his membership interest, his ownership interest, to themselves. That is not a recognized, that is not a proper use of a receivership proceeding. As counsel said, we can't infer improper use and intent. We have direct evidence of improper use. What they did is improper use.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you again, Mr. Marsh. We appreciate the arguments and the briefs of all counsel in the case. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. And Mr. Chair, well, both counsel, you can look for our order today, or hopefully today, if not today, tomorrow, just giving you until a week from today to respond to these three cases. And we'll set a page limit on you, or a word limit. So again, we thank you all. That concludes our 130 docket, our docket for today. The court will be in recess, and the bailiff may so announce.